Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of violence, war, murder, and torture.
On what foundation stands the warrior's pride? How just his hopes let Swedish Charles decide? A frame of adamant, a soul of fire, no dangers fright him, and no labors tire. Or love or force extends his wide domain. Unconquered lord of pleasure and of pain. No joys to him pacific scepters yield. War sounds the trump, he rushes to the field. Behold surrounding kings their power combine. One capitulate, and one resign. Peace courts his hand, but spread her charms in vain. Think nothing gained, he cries, till naught remain. On Moscow's walls, till Gothic standards fly, and all his mine beneath the polar sky. The march begins in military state, and nations on his eyes suspended wait. Stern famine guards the solitary coast, and winter barricades the realms of frost. He comes, nor want nor cold his course delay. Hide blushing glory, hide Pultowa's day. The vanquished hero leaves his broken bands, and shews his miseries in distant lands. Condemned a needy supplicant to wait, whilst ladies interpose and slaves debate. But did not chance at length her error mend? Did no subverted empire mark his end? Did rival monarchs give the fatal wound, or hostile millions press him to the ground? His fall was destined to a barren strand, a petty fortress, and a dubious hand. He left the name, at which the world grew pale, to point a moral, or adorn a tale. Samuel Johnson, The Vanity of Human Wishes, 1749. As night descended on the battlefield, the victorious Swedish army was in the middle of a desperate search. The men close to the Swedish king, Gustavus II Adolphus, scoured the grounds for any sign of him. Amongst one of the many piles of bodies, the awful truth was uncovered. King Gustavus II Adolphus was dead. He always led his men impetuously from the front, and his personal bravery had finally cost Sweden one of its greatest monarchs. Upon the king's death, Swedish arms faced continual setbacks at the hands of the Catholic coalition. However, the late king's incredible victories in the field were used as ammunition in the diplomatic backrooms of Europe when peace was finally proclaimed. By the end of the 30 Years' War, Sweden came out a lot richer than they were previously, both territorially and in terms of prestige. The country was a guarantor of the Peace of Westphalia, as well as a protector of all Protestants in Europe. The rule of the Swedish Empire fell into the hands of the king's sister, Kristina. She controlled an empire which comprised parts of the present-day countries of Finland, Denmark, Germany, Russia, Estonia, and Latvia, not to mention Sweden proper. Kristina was the last Swedish monarch who belonged to the royal house of Vasa. The Vasa dynasty had been responsible for making Sweden independent in the early 16th century, as well as turning the country into the preeminent nation in Northern Europe. Prior to this, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway were merged into a single entity, remembered as the Kalmar Union. Kristina abdicated the throne in 1654, converted to Catholicism, and exiled herself to Rome. The new dynasty was largely of South Germanic descent. The House of Palatinate Zweibrücken was characterized by a set of warrior kings who shaped the history of Northern, Central, and Eastern Europe for the next 80 years. Starting with Charles X, Sweden returned to military prominence and gained a reputation amongst European powers as a tenacious enemy who continually punched above their weight and did so successfully. During his short reign, Charles X completed several military campaigns of note. His most famous exploit was crossing the frozen straits of Denmark in order to place Copenhagen under direct threat. He also captured Warsaw and fought Russian armies to the point of a total standstill in countless fights. He died in 1660 after a prolonged battle with pneumonia, but not before obtaining the province of Scania. Charles X also introduced the reduction in his territory. This was an initiative to reclaim vast tracts of land held by the nobility. Under the previous Vasa dynasty, Swedish rulers looked for quick cash through the selling of royal properties to the nobility. This mainly affected Swedish peasants, while the Swedish treasury suffered from diminished returns. Reclaiming this land proved a boon for the royal coffers, while providing state land on which the peasantry could work and live. This reform was needed, as famine and plague had torn through Sweden, making life at work untenable for many peasants. Upon the death of Charles X, Charles XI ascended. However, the new king was just a child, so he quote-unquote ruled under a long regency council, but they failed the country in many respects. Michael Glaser says, quote, "There was excessive spending, declining revenues, and a reduction in military readiness," unquote. Sweden sought allies to protect their precarious empire from their many rivals. In 1672, Sweden and France formed an official alliance. In return for a large annual sum of money, Sweden needed to provide France with a 16,000-man army, which was to be ready at a moment's notice in Swedish Pomerania. In 1674, France called on their ally to formally invade Brandenburg. However, they were defeated outside the German town of Fehbrellen. Many of Sweden's rivals saw this as proof that the Swedish tiger had lost its fangs. Denmark had been waiting for such an opportunity, and they invaded the province of Scania in 1676. Charles XI mustered a force of 12,000 to meet the Danes. Around Lund, the two armies clashed in a climactic engagement. Stealing a page from his father's playbook, Charles XI rushed his soldiers across a frozen body of water and surprised the Danish left wing completely. The Swedish, under Charles XI, then wheeled about to rout the rest of the Danish army, who were mauling the Swedes who were left behind. Both sides suffered terribly in the fight, and considering the number of casualties, the Battle of Lund was a true bloodbath. Almost 70% of the Danes were made casualties, while the Swedish army supposedly lost 62% of their forces during the fight. Unfortunately for Sweden's imperial ambitions, the Danish navy was able to best the Swedish in almost every engagement. In 1679, France mediated a peace between the two powers. This infuriated Charles XI, as Swedish authorities were never informed about the treaty's contents until it was already formalized. As a result of this perceived second-class treatment from the French, Charles XI would maintain animosity towards them and their culture for the rest of his life. This would largely translate to his son, Charles XII. Besides the Swedish capture of the Danish province of Scania, Denmark's main issue with Sweden lay with their relations to the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp. Although Denmark maintained nominal vassalship of the duchy had recently requested military aid from Sweden. This geopolitical situation was untenable for both nations. Sweden's resources were stretched thin with defending the German-Danish duchy, while Denmark was placed in a strategic quagmire, with potential enemies bordering them to the north and south. One important aspect of the unstable peace which ended the Scania War was the marriage of Charles XI to the Danish princess Ulrika Eleonora. She quickly gained the admiration and love of her husband, as well as the Swedish people. The relationship between Charles XI and Ulrika was one of absolute love and devotion. At a time when most European monarchs had a bevy of mistresses to choose from, Charles XI never entertained the affections of other women, neither before or after he married Ulrika. They had 8 children together, but only 3 would live to see adulthood. These were Charles XII, as well as their 2 daughters, Hedvig Sophia and Ulrika Eleonora. Besides reforming the reputation of Swedish arms abroad, Charles XI set about reforming his lands so that he had a more direct hand in administering the realm. The reduction started by his father was taken into overdrive, and noble property was confiscated all across the empire for the benefit of the realm as a whole. Next, Charles XI began a new system of drafting soldiers into the armed forces, referred to as the Indelningsverk, or the allotment system. This system drafted semi-professional soldiers from the towns, farms, and villages, while those not drafted were tasked with clothing and supplying those who were chosen for service. This created a feeling of community between the army, the state, and the peasants. This was nothing new for Sweden. Since its inception as an independent state, the burghers, the clergy, and the peasantry all had a say in Swedish governance. Finally, in 1680, Charles XI called his councilmen and their Reichstag, or Senate, to formally grant him absolute power over all the affairs of state. It was granted by the Reichstag after he asked if he was still, quote-unquote, bound to the council and their advisory role in government. The Reichstag responded, quote, he, Charles XI, was not bound by anyone other than himself, unquote. This would make his son, Charles XII, the only Swedish monarch born and clothed in absolute power. Charles XI proved to be an absolute monarch who truly cared for his realm. His Lutheran faith imbued him with an incredible work ethic, and he constantly attempted to fix the issues of his state as he saw them. When Charles XI wasn't riding horses, hunting, or visiting churches, he would travel incognito across the realm to seek out evildoers and demand the king's justice. His religious temperament extended to the Swedish state, which was often described as the quote-unquote Lutheran Spain. Although Charles XI did many things to help the state, he was not tolerant of other religions. In the worst examples of his abuse of power, Jewish people and Catholics were forced to publicly recant their faith if they were discovered practicing in the open. Additionally, Carl Gustafsson Klingspor ruefully recounts the quote-unquote dozens of witches who were burned at the stake under the king's orders. Ulrika Eleonora, the king's wife, was a sickly person. In 1693, her health declined rapidly, and by the summer of that year, the queen was dead. Her last request was that all the money intended for her funeral would instead be distributed to the poor. Charles XI was inconsolable. He supposedly cried all 4 hours of her burial ceremony and more. Ulrika was his one true companion in life, and upon his own deathbed, he told his surviving mother that he, quote, never lived a single day in happiness, unquote, following the death of his beloved. The death of his mother greatly impacted Charles XII, who had a very close relationship to all the women in his family. Deep into the Great Northern War, the usually emotionless Charles burst into tears when recalling the memory of his mother. He was also incredibly close to his sister, Hedwig Sophia. Charles XII continued his courtly education. He much preferred the sciences to humanities, but idolized classical figures like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. He wanted to emulate these people, and when his tutors told him they both died young, it didn't seem to bother Charles in the least. He supposedly said that it did not matter if one died young, if they were able to conquer the world. Following the death of his mother, Charles began spending more and more time with his father during his hunting trips and stately visits to the various courts and churches of Sweden. Charles XII was a phenomenal hunter and a marksman who killed his first bear when he was only 12. Eventually, he grew tired of hunting with guns and began tracking down bears with sticks and spears. This was done to make it a quote-unquote fairer fight for both Charles and the bear. Besides these activities, the father and son pair loved wargaming and simulating battles, both on land and sea. These were notoriously violent affairs, and it was not uncommon for several of those participating to die in the quote-unquote mock fighting. These good times were not to last. Following the queen's death, the king began complaining about severe stomach pains, which rendered him incapable of riding his horse or performing his usual functions of state. These stomach pains continued unabated until it became clear that something was deeply wrong with the king. We now know that he suffered from an advanced form of stomach cancer, which rotted out his entire abdomen. Prior to his death, he had what can only be described as a vision. It was literally a dark and stormy night. The king was suffering from what he described as quote-unquote melancholy torments. He believed he saw a bright light illuminating the council chambers. This made no sense, as it was nearly midnight. His aides attempted to quell his fears by explaining the light was only the reflection of the moon. The king then swore he saw the shadows of people under the door, as if council was in session. A great terror filled the guardsmen and counselors present, and they all refused the king's demands that the door to the council chamber be opened. The king quaked with fear, but he summoned up his courage and unlocked the great doors to the room. He entered the room alongside his counselors and guardsmen, and they came upon a terrifying sight. He writes, quote, all of us were aware of a round table surrounded by revered men. Amongst them, a king between 16 and 18 years old. The young king shook his head several times, and these revered men brought their hands down hard on their books. Taking my eyes away, I beheld around the table block after block, executioner on executioner, all with their sleeves drawn up, and cutting off one head after another. I saw a throne nearly overturned. Unquote. The king was completely bewildered by what he was seeing, and he called out to God for some sort of answer, but none came. He cried out again and begged to know when these things were to pass and if they would occur in his lifetime. The young, spectral king who sat at the end of the table rose and answered, quote, not in thy time shall it come to pass, but in the sixth ruler's after thee, and he shall be of such an age and bearing as I am. The throne shall in the protector's later years be tottering to a fall. The guardians, who in the time of his regency did persecute the young king, shall thereafter espouse his cause, and they shall so establish the strength of the throne that never before have been, nor ever after be, so great a king as this one. His kingdom shall be free of debt, many millions in his treasury, but before he is secure on his throne, there shall be so great an outpouring of blood that shall exceed all ever seen before in Svealand, or shall be in time to come. Unquote. As the spectral young king said this, he, his ghostly administrators, the executioners and the rolling heads all vanished, and the council chamber returned to its previously empty and dark state. This vision could easily be interpreted as Charles XII, as he is only the sixth Swedish king to hold the royal name of Charles. The first Charles had assumed the regal number 6. Regardless, this striking vision was supposedly witnessed by numerous people. Whatever truly happened, it seems Charles XI believed he had this premonition. It came only months before his death from stomach cancer on April 5th, 1697. Charles XII was now an orphan at the age of 15. His reign began under a regency council which was headed by Charles's grandmother. His father had left Sweden in a prosperous position. The country had a growing economy, and there was a long-standing peace. He had tried to instill these virtues into his son as well. On his deathbed, he made his son swear to him that he would not start a war unless he was, quote, dragged by the hair, unquote. These lessons stuck with Charles XII, who endeavored to remain at peace while maintaining eternal vigilance. He rose at 5 every morning in an attempt to emulate his father's rigorous work schedule. Besides being an early riser, he much preferred life under the open sky. He was famous for his horse riding, which wound through many dozens of miles of Swedish countryside. Charles first started riding a horse when he was just 4, and he believed these rides were natural cures for any number of mental or physical ailments. Later in life, his aides and lieutenants would wait on his regular routes in the hopes of gaining an audience with the king. The Regency Council, which ruled Sweden in the king's name, was never powerful or confident in their decision-making. They wanted more than anything to hand over the reins of power to the young Charles, but there was no precedent for such a thing. Swedish kings who had ascended during their minority never gained full recognition as monarchs until they were 17 or 18. Charles XII, however, would break this tradition. He accepted the calls from his counselors and the Senate to assume total control of the state, as was his quote-unquote divine right as the absolute monarch. Before he ascended, a coronation, or in this case an anointing, by the head bishop of Sweden was held. There were several ominous signs which led up to the ceremony. First, the Tre Kronor Castle burned down. Come the day of the anointing, Charles insisted on wearing the crown to the ceremony instead of being crowned there. Upon mounting his horse, this crown clattered to the ground. During the ceremony, he refused to swear a sacred oath which all Swedish kings had hitherto sworn. These signs, coupled with an incredibly harsh winter and the king's obstinate behavior, foreshadowed ill tidings for many in attendance. Charles, however, believed he was demonstrating his own iron will and showing any doubters that he was the sole arbiter of power in Sweden. Charles XII came to power at a time when Sweden was courting many possible geopolitical relationships. The rule of his father was defined by peace and isolation, but this left Sweden alone on the world stage. This had to be rectified, especially in a world where interweaving alliances were defining strategic warfare. In terms of population and economic strength, France was the preeminent power in Europe. In previous decades, France and Sweden were allied through many storms, in spite of their religious differences. The maritime powers of England and the Netherlands were interested in gaining the friendship of Sweden as well. The combined fleets of England and the Netherlands proved the deciding factor in cementing an alliance between these two countries and Sweden. Officially called the Altona Agreement, the alliance was designed to counter any combinations levied against the Swedish state, as well as prevent any disruption to Baltic trade routes. Besides geopolitical concerns, Charles XII and his court at Stockholm were beset by numerous princesses who sought the king's hand in marriage. Throughout the course of his life, Charles rebuffed any attempt at marriage. He claimed to not have the time for matrimony, especially once the Great Northern War began. He also said that if he married, he would marry for love, as opposed to a marriage of political convenience. His lack of interest in marriage and women has led some historians to speculate that he was gay. Whether that is the truth or not, it is of little importance. Charles was also described as socially awkward and seemed most at home on the battlefield or on the campaign trail. Eventually, the alliance between Sweden and Holstein-Gottorp was solidified with the marriage of Charles's sister to the dukedom's leader, Frederick IV. Frederick and Charles got along very well. Frederick was able to draw out the delinquent in Charles. During his stay in Stockholm, he and the king rabble-roused all across the capital. In one instance, the two were naked, save for shirts, and seen traversing Stockholm on horseback and breaking all the windows they could find. In another instance, the duke swore he had a sword which could decapitate livestock and even bears in a single swing. Charles then hunted several kinds of animals and brought them to the royal castle. He and the duke then took turns decapitating these animals and tossing the severed heads onto the people below. A bear who was captured ate an entire cake. He was forced to drink a barrel of wine and then fell out the window and died of a broken back. Unsurprisingly, this period is remembered as the Gottorp Fury, or the Mad Period. Upon the duke's departure, Charles returned to his senses. Never again would he be in such a state of debauchery and drunkenness. As this occurred, the courts of Central and Eastern Europe were conspiring against Charles, whom they believed that they could easily trounce in a fight. The first stirrings of conspiracy were whispered in Livonia. Livonia was arguably the richest province in the Swedish Empire. It served as a valuable port, which funneled trade from Russia and Siberia into greater European markets. Additionally, Livonian nobility suffered the most at the hands of the Swedish reduction. Vast tracts of noble land were now the crown lands of Sweden. This upset several nobles who felt their ancient privileges were being threatened from, quote-unquote, overseas. Amongst these nobles there was Johann Reinhold Patkul. Patkul wished to create an anti-Swedish coalition of nations in the hopes of forming an independent Livonian country. He is a controversial figure, with some seeing him as an early proponent of Baltic nationalism, while others consider him a petty tyrant who only wanted Livonia to be quote-unquote free so that he could enrich himself and the rest of the Livonian nobility. This coalition was built slowly over the course of several years. Denmark was the most natural partner, since their rivalry with Sweden was centuries old. Following the death of Christian V in 1699, the new Danish king, confusingly called Frederick IV, sought to reestablish Danish authority over several lost provinces, as well as the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp. He went so far as to unofficially invade the duchy and raise several border forts they were in the process of constructing. In the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania, the newly elected king and Holy Roman Elector, who was also a cousin to Charles, Augustus the Strong of Saxony, also sought to expand his realm. He wanted to make the Polish crown hereditary through his Saxon bloodline. He believed the best way to ingratiate himself with the Polish nobility was through the conquest of Swedish Livonia. Michael Glaser says Augustus was remembered for, quote, his physical strength, patronage of the arts, and his many mistresses, unquote. Other Germanic nations were asked to join the coalition against Sweden. Amongst them were the Duchy of Brandenburg, the newly minted Kingdom of Prussia, and the Duchy of Hanover. All these powers bided their time and withheld their support for the time being. The final piece of this anti-Swedish pact was Tsar Peter I of Russia, also known as Peter the Great. Following the death of his brother, Peter became the sole sovereign of Russia. He was ambitious, far-sighted, and cruel to the extreme. When he was first asked to join the anti-Swedish alliance, he was in the middle of his great embassy to Europe. He traveled across Western Europe in the hopes of forming an alliance to fight against the Ottoman Empire, but he was also there to learn more about European statecraft and quote-unquote civilization. Peter wanted more than anything to turn Russia into a preeminent world power, which could compete with any of the countries in Europe. He did this by destroying the once sacrosanct institutions which existed in Russia prior to his rule. He demanded his boyars and the common people shave their beards and amend their dress to be more in line with European standards. This first reform came as a serious shock, as it went against religious precepts in Russia. Russian Orthodoxy, prior to Peter's reign, maintained that an unshaven beard was needed to gain access to heaven. Due to this belief, Russian peasants kept their shaved beards under their beds, with the intention of presenting them to St. Peter when they died. Peter then endeavored to do away with his first wife, Eudoxia. Michael W. Simmons says, quote, through no fault of her own, Eudoxia had always bored Peter, unquote. Peter preferred his Western mistresses and his orgies, and wished to have a free hand to choose what he saw as a quote-unquote more competent wife and empress. The only way he could do this without breaking Russian law was by convincing her to join a convent. At first, she refused to go, arguing that she had a maternal responsibility to their son, Alexei. Peter decided to remove Alexei from her household and forced his wife into a convent, regardless of her protests. Peter then tried to reform the Russian military. He invited foreign officers from across Europe to drill his men in European line formation. Following protests and small outbreaks of rebellion by the Streltsy Royal Guard, Peter ruthlessly culled this unit from Russia's military. Thousands were broken on the wheel and gibbeted in public. Under torture, several Streltsy claimed that they were given their orders by Sophia, Peter's former regent, whom he also exiled to a convent. In front of the convent she was cloistered in, Austrian bystanders said, quote, there were 30 gibbets erected in a quadrangle shape, from which there hung 230 Streltsy. The principal ringleaders were hanged close to the windows that the princess might with ease touch them, unquote. The coalition's plan for the invasion of Sweden was relatively simple. The Danish believed the maritime powers would not honor their agreements with Sweden. Due to this belief, Danish forces would invade the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp and then attack Sweden directly in the province of Scania. At the same time, Saxon forces under Augustus were to invade Livonia and capture the main city of Riga. Russia would stagger their invasion of Ingria in the hopes of catching Sweden off guard. The invasions of Holstein and Livonia began in earnest on March 11, 1700. Instead of being bewildered or caught off guard by the news, Charles was nonplussed. He was in the middle of a bear hunt when he found out, and with total composure he turned to the French minister accompanying him and said, quote, we shall soon oblige them to return back the same way they came." Unquote. At this remark, the king turned his horse around and rode to Stockholm for the last time in his life. The next 18 years would be defined by conquest, victory, defeat, exile, betrayal, and eventually, death. Calling his counselors and subordinates together, he spoke of the war and what he expected from them and the nation. He had already bolstered the army to nearly 90,000 men and had dispatched reinforcements to far-off Swedish possessions and tributaries like Livonia, Ingria, and Holstein. He said this brazen attack by a coalition of nations proved that Sweden was in the right and that they had God on their side. He then said, quote, "I have resolved never to start an unjust war, but never to end a legitimate one, except by defeating my enemies." Unquote. Sweden was never truly in a position to be an empire. At the start of the 18th century, economists claimed the Swedish state had a similar economy to that of France 500 years previous. In terms of population, Sweden and Finland only had 1.5 million residents. If you included, quote-unquote, overseas Swedish territory, this number balloons to 2.5 to 3 million inhabitants. Comparatively, France had over 20 million subjects, Russia had 16 million, and Wales and England had over 5 million. The only enemy with whom they had a population parity was Denmark-Norway. This meant that in every war, and basically every engagement, Swedish forces were outnumbered. To counter this irreconcilable issue, Swedish armies adopted a professionalism which was only just coming into vogue in Western Europe and was still non-existent in many parts of Central and Eastern Europe. Besides their professionalism, Swedish armies employed gapa, or go-to offensive tactics, in order to subdue their numerically superior enemies. Gapa tactics were based around close-range musketry volleys, followed by massive infantry and cavalry charges, which were intended to break the enemy before the fight devolved into a shooting match or a battle for attrition. To accomplish this feat, Swedish armies utilized several distinct features. First, a third of their forces were pikemen. Pikes had fallen out of favor across most of Europe, especially as technology improved, and cumbersome flintlock muskets gave way to more versatile matchlocks. Additionally, the Swedes did not often use pikes as defensive weapons. Instead, they employed pikes as shock infantry. Secondly, their forces were nearly 50% cavalry-based. This turned the Swedish army into a highly mobile force, and Charles was not against leading solely cavalry into battle, especially if his infantry was lagging behind, and he saw an opportunity to deliver a defeat to his enemies. Finally, Charles helped to revolutionize artillery and field engagements. Early in the war, Charles neglected his artillery, and this had consequences toward the effectiveness of his bullheaded charges. Due to this, he began organizing regimental guns, which were to be brought out with the infantry and were expected to keep pace. This soon became the norm throughout the world and would remain the case until the days of massed artillery and huge conscript armies. The armies were composed of mercenary German and native Swedish troops, but as the war progressed and more territory was lost in Europe, more native Swedes took up arms. In summation, Michael Glaser says, quote, "Firepower was secondary to cold steel, and thus closing in on the foe was preferred to long-range firefights." Unquote. The Swedish Empire was now at war. The Danes crashed across the defenses of the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp without a declaration of war, and moved to besiege their main fortress of Tönning. Charles gathered his forces together and waited for his allies, the English and the Dutch, to bring a fleet to the Danish Straits. As it stood, The Swedish navy could not compete with the Danish, but combined with the English and Dutch, they proved to be an overwhelming armada, which forced the Danish to retreat to the safety of their home ports rather than risk annihilation. Having total control of the straits, Charles proposed a bold landing on Zealand and then a rapid march to the capital city of Copenhagen. The Dutch and the English were poor allies. Henrik O. Ounce says, quote, "Help from the maritime powers was both calculated and limited," unquote. They were mostly concerned with maintaining the balance of power in Europe and hoped that both sides would eventually stalemate into peace. Charles decided to strike out on his own, and he demanded the Swedish fleet navigate the treacherous Flintranan, or the Danish Flats. These were shallow waters which had never been successfully traversed by any navy thus far. Swedish admiral protested that such a feat would be impossible. At this remark, Charles accused the admiral who had single-handedly built up the Swedish fleet of cowardice. The admiral at once relented and began his maneuvers. A few ships were lost in the dangerous crossing, but this maneuver surprised the Danish to such an extent that they failed to adequately challenge the landings of Swedish troops. On July 24, 1700, the landings began, and Charles was amongst the second wave of troops. He was so eager to face combat that he leapt into the water on horseback before his transport even reached the beach. Following his example, his retinue and the rest of the men aboard joined their king and waded through the waters onto the beach. Danish cavalry was harassing the landings in increasing numbers, but Charles did not seem to mind the whizzing bullets. In fact, he seemed delighted. He said the sound of the bullets, quote, "shall henceforth be my band," unquote. By early August, the Swedish host had swelled to over 10,000 men, and plans were being drawn up for the bombardment and storming of Copenhagen. The Danish were completely blindsided, and to make matters worse, a Dutch-English army was pushing in on Danish forces from the south. Forced into a corner, the Danish state wrote a hurried peace treaty and signed it with the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp. The treaty promised to respect the duchy's sovereignty, pay for the cost of the campaign, and swore to end the Danish support of King Augustus and his armies in Livonia. In 2 weeks, Denmark, Sweden's biggest rival in the region, was removed from the conflict and forced into a humiliating peace. Charles was prepared to storm Copenhagen, peace treaty be damned, but his aides and the administrators he brought with him compelled the king to acquiesce to the accepted peace, as well as the request of Sweden's allies. The quick ending on this front of the war allowed Charles the space he needed to assist Swedish forces in Estonia and Ingria. He reassembled his transport fleet and set out for Estonia. After an intense storm, he landed in Pärnu on October 6th. This whole time, Augustus had tried and failed to capture the Latvian city of Riga. He had invaded without a declaration of war, so he was not prepared for such stiff resistance to his forces. Patkel had convinced him that the defenses of Riga were weak and could be stormed relatively easily. Unfortunately for Polish designs, the Swedish garrison, led by the brilliant military engineer Erik Dahlgren, stubbornly defended the city and even forced the Saxon army into retreat and then into winter quarters early. Upon hearing the news from Denmark, Augustus reached out to the Sun King of France, Louis XIV, to mediate peace. However, Charles was determined to punish his treacherous cousin and refused all mentions of peace until Sweden had a better bargaining position. Sweden's mainland administration was being controlled by a bureaucracy who coolly handled crisis after crisis and were constantly able to provide Charles with reinforcements whenever he requested them. This speaks volumes about the nameless administrators and pencil pushers who kept Sweden afloat while the country's king fought an endless war. Charles demanded to be kept up to date about the goings-on back in court, and he made it a point to dictate all matters of foreign policy personally. This devotion to duty was equally true for the camp followers, doctors, soldiers, and farmers who composed the Swedish army. They were people from all corners of Europe. This vast array of people mainly used the Germanic language as opposed to Swedish. This polyglot force. With Augustus on the run, Charles turned to the beleaguered fortress town of Narva in present-day Estonia. R. Nisbet Bain says, quote, "The town of Narva is situated on a narrow neck of land, round which the Narva River makes a wide bend." Peter had recently concluded his Azov campaign, freeing him up to declare war on Sweden in late August. He was at the head of a massive army of over 40,000 Russians, who had laid waste to the countryside and were besieging the fortress at present. Things were desperate for the Swedes inside Narva, so Charles endeavored to liberate the garrison. He marched his men over terrible roads in barren country, with winter nipping at the heels of the Swedes. The confidence Charles's soldiers and officers had in him momentarily wavered in the face of these miserable conditions. Even his stalwart supporters began to see the folly in attacking a force which was three times as large as the army of Sweden. John Reinskjold, one of Sweden's best generals, said, quote, "If the king succeeds, there never was anyone who had to triumph over such obstacles," unquote. On November 17th, a small detachment of Swedes, headed by Charles, came into contact with 5,000 Russians defending the Pyhäjoki Pass. They rapidly withdrew in the face of the blue-clad Swedish warriors. Tsar Peter had instructed the Russian commander to do as much, but Swedish propaganda turned this retreat into a major battle and rout of Russian forces. This emboldened and heartened the army as they pushed into the outskirts of the besieged city of Narva. On the Russian side, Peter believed that any fight would occur after the Swedish had rested, built a fortified camp, and gathered supplies. This was usually how field battles were conducted. Very rarely were generals impetuous enough to strike boldly into the unknown, but Charles was prepared to do just that. Peter, meanwhile, left his army under the command of a French general who was absolutely hated by the men under his command. The Russian army was a miscellaneous grouping of peasant conscripts who were hemmed in by their own fortifications. In a style similar to the Roman siege of the Gallic city of Alesia, they had built double walls around the city to besiege it and around their army to protect themselves. R. Nisbet Bain says these fortifications were, quote, "defended by 140 cannons." However, the Karelians were not the Gallic hordes of yesteryear, and the Russians were not Roman legionaries. Charles recognized that these fortifications hindered Russian movement, so he decided to attack their position immediately with his exhausted army of barely 15,000. He lined up his infantry into two distinct columns. Both were designed to crash into and devastate the Russian center at different ends, and then rapidly fall on their flanks. Following closely behind the infantry, two sets of Swedish cavalry were placed on each flank. The Swedish army was so small in comparison to that of the Russians that the French general in command was convinced that this force was only a feint or the vanguard for a larger attack. Due to this, he neglected to adequately position his troops to brace for the Swedish charge. The entire Russian position was supposedly protected from the center by a huge hill which was topped with artillery and chevaux de frise, or anti-cavalry wooden stakes. This was deemed the most defensible area by the Russians. Therefore, it was selected by Charles as the point on which the infantry assault would be focused. At 2 p.m. on November 17, 1700, the Swedish attack was about to commence when a massive snowstorm arrived. Swedish generals began calling off the attack all across the line, but Charles would hear nothing of it. he explained to his officers that the storm was being whipped up into the faces of the Russians. He ordered his officers to execute the assault as planned. All along the Swedish line, their battle cry, quote, God med hjälp, unquote, or with God's help, rippled like a wave through the Scandinavians, Balts, Finns, and Germans who composed the Karelians. As the Swedish came into effective combat range, the Russian musketeers were completely blinded with snow. This made their first volley ineffective, as many shots flew over the heads of the Swedes. The first Swedish volley, delivered at point-blank range, devastated the Russians. Robert Massey says this Swedish volley caused the Russians to fall, quote, like grass, unquote. The next Russian volley was more effective and killed many Swedes, but by that point, Swedish swords and pikes were leveled and the men were charging up and over the 9-foot walls and slaughtering Russians in droves. What was a battle was now an absolute massacre of the Russians, who were hemmed in by the fortifications they had built to protect themselves. Swedish cavalry followed close behind. Once they were out in the open, they rampaged through Russian units. Unlike other militaries of the time who charged their horses at a trot, Swedish cavalry charged at full tilt, knee to knee. The Swedes then proceeded to roll up the Russian flank, carrying beleaguered Russians into the teeth of the besieged city. At this point, the Swedish garrison sallied out, throwing their weight behind the assault. The only Russian units which held were the recently commissioned European-style guard units, who formed a square formation and held out atop a hill until the end of the fighting, when they ultimately surrendered. All throughout the fight, Charles was at the front, encouraging his men and suffering alongside them. Besides having his horse shot out from under him, he was struck with a bullet in his chest. Though its velocity had tapered off significantly and it fell harmlessly from his cravat after the battle, it would be the first of 5 bullets to strike him. The only escape for the Russians was over a single bridge, which collapsed under the weight of the thousands of panicked conscripts. Thousands drowned in the Narva River. The few who escaped ran a panicked route back to their families. Those Russians who were still fighting were compelled to surrender to King Charles. At the cost of about 1,800 casualties, the Swedish army had killed or drowned 9,000 Russians, forced over 20,000 to surrender, and effectively annihilated the only Russian army between Charles and Moscow. There were so many Russian POWs that Charles was worried these prisoners would be able to launch a successful mutiny. With a single gesture of his hand, all the Russians, not of high rank, were released unconditionally, while Russian officers remained imprisoned for several years. Besides the losses in men, Russia had lost all its artillery and nearly all of their battle standards. Tsar Peter was forced to melt down church bells to rapidly churn out new pieces of artillery because the Swedish army had so completely decimated the Russian reserves. Charles was now an international sensation. Early newspapers like the London Gazette were lauding his praises, while songs and poems sprang up in honor of Swedish arms and the country's teenage king. Michael Glaser says, quote, Charles was faced with a critical decision that many historians since have deemed as fatal to his empire, unquote. Charles could continue his march south and threaten Moscow, or he could turn west and challenge the hitherto undefeated Saxon armies of his cousin, Augustus I. If Charles continued south and attempted to knock Russia out of the Great Northern War, his flanks would be undoubtedly threatened from the west. However, if he attacked Poland and then Saxony, his rear would theoretically be less harassed by recently defeated Russian forces. Additionally, it was midwinter, and the Swedish army was already suffering from exposure and disease. most important for Charles, was that he ruined Augustus and forced him to concede his title as King of Poland. Beyond any tactical considerations, the campaign against Poland was a personal matter for Charles. Bearing all this in mind, his decision to veer into Poland and then into Saxony was logical as well as emotional. After a lengthy winter laden with disease and death, Charles was determined to never maintain a closed military camp again. Without modern medical breakthroughs like vaccines, armies were always ravaged with illness when enclosed in camp for the winter. It was a similar case with American revolutionaries over 70 years later at Valley Forge. With the new year, 1701, Charles marched his army south towards Riga, where he planned to effect the crossing of the Dwina River. The Swedes started crossing in the night, and by the morning of July 9th, many Swedes were across the Dwina and in Polish Commonwealth territory. They effected this crossing under enemy attack and with the assistance of smoke barges, which Charles set aflame to hide his men's approach. Facing them was the Saxon army of Augustus, which was considered highly professional, quote-unquote, Western and modernized. They attempted repeated assaults against the Swedes who were arriving on the riverbanks, but the Swedes held out and pushed the Saxons back each time. They inflicted thousands of casualties against them and proved their tactics were just as effective on the defensive. Once across the river, Charles made an ominous prediction. He said, quote, "We shall be fighting on this side of the water for many years to come," unquote. He would be proved right, as the next 6 years of war would be defined by constant marching, battles, guerrilla warfare, political intrigue, and the slaughter of civilians in Poland. It was during the Polish campaign that Charles first gained his reputation as a war hound and a butcher. In the next episode, we will explore the intricacies of this campaign and the quest for retribution on which Charles embarked against his own kin. I hope you've all enjoyed this episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. If you like the show, one way you can help us reach more people is by writing a review. While it may not seem like it, reviews help expose more people to the Turning Tides podcast. And we really appreciate any help we can get with reaching a wider audience. Thank you all so much again for tuning in, and have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support, and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.